This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, episode 7, 1966, part 2.
I needed a method for Thor to fly, to go from Asgard, which is the home of the gods, to the Earth. I didn't want him to just say, I think I'll get going, and bingo, we see him fly. If you ever thought about it, Superman flies with no visible means of propulsion. But I wanted Thor to have a real method of flying, so I figured he'll take his hammer and put a little leather thong and wrap it around his wrist. And then he'll swing the hammer very fast, like a propeller. And when it gets going at top speed, he'll let it go. Now, the hammer will go flying off, but because the thong is tied to his wrist, it'll pull him along with it. So you see, everything I ever wrote was scientifically sound, and nobody could criticize it or fault it.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast. My name is Nick Duke, your host of this here show, and I am back once more to guide you along on our year-by-year journey through Marvel's publishing history. We are up to 1966, Part 2. And as always, I do not dare tread this path alone, because along with me are the Sarcastic Four, beginning with Tim Capel. Tim, how are you this fine evening?
Man himself.
I'm quite fine. I'm now leaping from my place of concealment. At least I would if there was so little dignity in leaping when a breath would serve me just as well. I've been eating all day, trying to recover from our festivities, which the nation will be hearing about in short order.
Coming weeks. We had quite the happening the other night in the Place to Be Nation comics community that we look forward to sharing with you in audio form in the very near future. And the person most responsible for bringing that to you is, of course, the manager himself, Mr. Todd Weber. Todd, how are you tonight?
I have both a breath and a leap because I am the breather and Batroc Z Leaper. But it was pretty epic Friday night's shenanigans.
You may notice, dear listeners, that our voices sound a little bit more subdued than typical, and I think it's because we're all still in the midst of like a 48-hour hangover. So this should be certainly a unique edition of the Marvel Age podcast. But it wouldn't be the Sarcastic Four without a fourth member, Mr. Russell Sellers. How are you tonight?
I'm tired.
You're tired and everything.
Yes, my body aches, and I blame all of you. But it was a blast of an evening, one that will certainly go down as another legendary moment in the comics contingent history. So
it'll go down in the annals.
Yeah, it will.
appropriately enough, because one of the people on this year's show right now was able to draft both Luke. Oh, was able to yes draft. I'll spoil it for you. It was the draft. Was able to draft both Luke Cage and Jessica Jones, so the annals of history are certainly appropriate for that term.
That's right. It was a bed-breaking experience if ever there was one.
Cool. Man. But we're not here to talk about such things. You'll get to hear about those in due time. We are here to pick back up our discussion on 1966 in Marvel Comics. Last time out, we covered arguably the two flagship books for Marvel at this point, those, of course, being The Fantastic Four and The Amazing Spider-Man. And this time out, we're going to kind of take you through a little bit of a scattershot of various titles that were dotting the landscape of Marvel. And I can't think of any better place to start, and by better, I mean any worse place to start, than with Tony Stark. We're going to hop back over to Tales of Suspense, which we haven't had on our list in a little while, and we're going to talk some Iron Man as we open with Tales of Suspense 78, which, you know, I guess we need to start tracking these sorts of things, Tim, don't we, about where we instances where we question the reading list, because
yeah,
this is like a single issue that picks directly up from a cliffhanger from an issue we didn't read, and I guess it's only notable because it introduces Ultimo, But wasn't he technically introduced in the issue prior to this?
Previous issue. I think, to me, 78 is notable for the team-up of the two Titans story in the book. But also, we get our first official introduction to a new artist, Gene Colan, I think that's the deal. That's Adilio.
And that's one thing, you know, we're going to talk about actually four issues of Tales of Suspense here, because 78, 79, 80, and 81 were all on our reading list. So we're just going to tackle all these at the start of the show. You know, we have all, to varying degrees, buried this Iron Man stuff thus far on our reading list. But I have to say, the one saving grace this time out, I thought the Gene Colan art was outstanding. And honestly, I thought it was better when it was Tony Stark outside of the Iron Man armor than it was when he was doing action sequences. Like, Tony Stark being put through the emotional ringer of having his company shut down by the government and stuff, I kind of dug those bits. They felt moody and atmospheric, whereas the action stuff was just kind of – it was fine, I guess. What about you, Todd? What did you make of these?
Yeah, I appreciate the Colan stuff just because it is moody. It's dark. That's a good word for it, and that's kind of the I think of Gene Colan, and I think of Doctor Strange, and I think of books like Night Force for DC, which was kind of an obscure title, but it was nothing if not moody. So I do like that we get just another competent artist added to the roster. So much Ditko and so much Kirby to this point that we have another guy, in addition to, say, Don Heck, who can competently draw and add his own things. And you look – the things about Colan, I mean, the bodies are always kind of askew. They're always somewhat dark, and the panels are a little bit unusual. It's not just, you know, nine uniform panels. You get one big panel and then some very side panels. So I think the art itself does a great job with storytelling, and it's just nice to have another change of pace of art here. The guy who drew for years and years.
Yeah, 66, you're really starting to see Marvel expand their creative roster. Because, I mean, we talked about last time, you got John Romita Jr. coming in. This time out, of course, you have Gene Colan. And then there's a writer, actually, I want to talk about here in a little bit when we get to Strange Tales. But, Russell, you've buried this Iron Man stuff pretty hard. I don't think this was great or anything, but I think it was at least better than some of the other Iron Man stuff we've read. Not 78, but I'm talking more like 79 or 80, you know, 80 and 81, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I only just like really skimmed over that part because it just wasn't really holding my interest all that much. But the I can agree that the art is really, really great. Gene Colan got my attention immediately, and I actually really liked his action sequences here with the Ultimo stuff in 78. Although the exuberant amount of expository dialogue
every issue,
every freaking issue,
every this, issue is someone's first issue.
Yep.
Yeah, or last.
And boy, I wouldn't be putting this on my pull list, but especially 78, where it's like, holy shit, I don't feel like any of this is necessary. This could have been three pages long. And you're right that the bits with Iron Man dealing with the loss of his company. And really, I think this is the first instance of that we've seen in Tony Stark's history. So it's kind of an important moment to realize that he's being, you know, shut down by the government, and he's about to take on a challenge that he can't suit up and punch his way out of. So it's interesting for that aspect, but it's not something that I was, as I was going through it, like, oh man, I can't wait to see what happens next. It was more like, oh, this is moderately less terrible than the last time I was in an Iron Man story.
Yeah, that's how I guess that's a good way of describing it. I would call it just utterly forgettable, at least. Like, it doesn't leave you with the bad taste in mouth that the previous Iron Man stuff did. So it's at least an improvement in that regard, but I can't say it leaves any kind of dramatic impression. Tim, what about you, man? Did this was there any impression left upon you by this Iron Man stuff?
Yeah, similar to you guys. On the one hand, okay, Gene Colan. Fuck yeah, I love Gene Colan art. He loves his use of shadows, man.
Yes.
And
yes.
I don't know that it's employed to the greatest effect on something like Iron Man, but
I was wondering that. Yeah, good point.
It is refreshing to me when, as you said, we've been used to the Jack Kirby's and the Don Hecks of the world who I don't know if we've said it before on this show, but there was a saying, I think, in the Marvel bullpen at this time that Stan Lee wanted Jack Kirby to be Jack Kirby. He wanted Steve Ditko to be Steve Ditko, and he wanted every other artist to be Jack Kirby.
One of those two, yeah.
So this is definitely a departure from that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Colin is similar or following in the footsteps of either of these guys. He's someone who, honestly, he had quite the career prior to doing this work for Marvel's superhero line. He worked on pretty much everything except their superhero books. And he'd been on Tales of Suspense for a little bit. He'd been doing Tales to Astonish as well, which we'll take a look at shortly in this same episode. But this is the first time we're getting a chance to talk about him on this program. So great to see. On the other hand, it is an Iron Man story. So a 60s Iron Man story. Mixed bag, yeah. I don't think I can add much to that from what you guys were saying. Unfortunately, there's some more Mandarin in here as well, and that's always going to be shaky. But I just appreciated this for the kind of upgrade in art that we're seeing.
Absolutely. But that wasn't the only thing that we noticed here in Tales of Suspense that was a little different than when we last visited the title, because this time Iron Man has got a full-fledged co-star. No, they're not co-starring in Adventures Together, but Captain America has taken over. I don't really know if I'd even call them backup features, guys. I think the book is pretty evenly split. Yeah, it may be off books by like a page, yeah, or something like that, but you know, it's a pretty close to a 50-50 split. So now we have Captain America here in his own ongoing solo adventures rather than just being featured in Avengers. And interestingly enough, even though the guy is massively busy, Jack Kirby is still guiding the adventures of Captain America from an art standpoint. Here in these issues, we get to see a little brief crossover between Nick Fury and Captain America, some acknowledgement that the two had crossed paths before back in World War II, although I'm 99.9% sure that's a retcon. And then you get to see the return of the Red Skull to the modern day continuity. And, you know, hard to believe now, but it's crazy how much better these Captain America stories were than the Iron Man stories. But probably not that surprising to Tim.
No, I've read a lot of these stories, most of these stories before. Stan and Jack just clearly have so much affinity for this character and must have relished the opportunity to bring him back into the modern landscape of the Marvel superhero universe in the 60s. You know, this whole man out of time concept we talked about being a real stroke of genius, really, on their part. And it does make sense that we've established that Nick Fury was this, you know, kind of wartime hero. He's still got his Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos book running alongside all of this, telling those stories. And it makes sense that there'd be some degree of overlap. There's a lot of undocumented time that they could take a look at and pair these two off. So beyond that, I mean,
would you argue that the undocumented time for Captain America was a gift for later writers?
Yes, very much so. One of whom I think we'll be seeing some, just the tip of the iceberg. Certainly a gift, and a gift to us as well, because these stories are very readable. This being the second half of 66 being the hodgepodge of titles that it is. So I didn't get a ton out of that Nick Fury team up in Suspense 78, other than saying, okay, yeah, this makes sense. Call it a retcon, sure, but that's nothing new to Stan and Jack here. We get the, I guess, kind of first appearance of them as AIM. That'll get a little bit garbled, I thought, as this goes on. I mean, are they called them? Are they called AIM? Is AIM a division of them? It starts to turn into a who's on first joke.
Once I see the Beekeeper helmets, they're AIM. They can call them whatever they want to, but I'm going to refer to them as AIM because of my, you know, my retroactive knowledge, I guess, is the only way I can
It's kind of funny because you have Iron Man against the Soviets and you have Captain America against the escaped against the Soviets again, and then Captain America against Germans such as Wolfgang and Horst, yes. plus the Red Skull and his helmets. So xenophobic paranoia is still going on pretty rampantly here.
That's one thing I was going to bring up, not to backtrack at all, but like, did anybody else feel like Gene Colan drew the Mandarin more in a more stereotypical fashion than he had previously appeared? I don't know. Yes. It's just something about the appearance that struck me as like even more like digging into to the Asian stereotypes.
It was hammed up a bit for sure.
Yeah.
A little hammed.
Sorry. Not to derail Todd's point about, you know, these.
No. If we're going to talk xenophobia, let's paint with a really broad brush.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Todd, I'm glad you mentioned the henchman of Wolfgang. He was quite the snazzy dresser, this underling of the newly introduced or reintroduced Red Skull, which probably the most notable development coming out of this Tales of Suspense run that we looked at. It's issues 79 through 81. But yeah, Wolfgang, how about
Ascot?
Red Skull's got the ascot, right?
And Wolfgang too.
Well, Wolfgang also has like a Hawaiian shirt on, it looks like. when he greets the Red Skull, who they're quite cordial, and then we learn that the Red Skull is employing some mind control technology, all kinds of sinister usage of technology as well here, that I don't know, that seems maybe, if not a deliberate justification or juxtaposition, I should say, against Captain America, who is decidedly low-tech with just his shield and I think some magnets built into his gloves that he refers to at one point. So there's maybe something worth looking at.
We do get a panel I've never seen before where Tony Stark and his scientist friends built a printed circuit beneath the A of his head mask
that was
kind of
cool. Yeah,
any hypnotic waves. I'd never seen that before, so I like that panel quite a
bit. I thought the Cosmic Cube stuff in the Red Skull story when Kirby was kind of getting to cut loose, I thought that stuff was really cool from an artistic standpoint. It gave Captain America something really visually engaging to bump up against. So yeah, I dug pretty much that whole Red Skull bit. What about you, Russell? How did the Captain America stuff sit with you?
For a minute there, this was my favorite thing we've read during the second half of the year. Cause I loved this Captain America story. And it was a hit with me pretty early on. I mean, even though at first I was a little shaky on the oddness of having a group called them, once it was revealed to be AIM, I was like, okay, I'm in. But like you said, all the Cosmic Cube stuff, right on. Loved everything that they were doing there. If I had one criticism of this whole thing is that I don't appreciate all this political commentary in my Captain America stories, and I feel like Stan Lee needs to just stick to superheroes being superheroes. Yeah, just stick to your comics enough with this.
What an SJW.
Yeah, really. It's like they're getting all triggered over Nazis having different opinions from them. I mean, come on. It's not that bad. They're good people on both sides. And that's enough of that. So
unite the Reich.
Yep. That's exactly what I see going on here. I love it. And, but now what, one thing I did love about this, in the opening chapter of it that we read was the idea that Cap can see the enemies that he's fighting, but nobody else can. Because they're using a form of hypnotic suggestion to everyone around Cap. And it had a very, like, they live kind of thing to it. And it made me read Cap in Roddy Piper voice. So that's something that I think was worth it all along. I love stuff like that. So that was a good bit of fun for me. So this is the moment, I think, where I think it's revealed that Cap could absolutely carry his own solo title and needs to again very soon within all this. So big thumbs up to all this. Maybe it's not like hugely groundbreaking stuff, but between the Kirby art and just the flow of the story and how well Cap is treated throughout, I got to say this is the return to form for Captain America that I was waiting on.
To me, at this point, you really Strange Tales last year. Stan is all about the serialization, how everything ties in to the last chapter. I mean, just keep it going. Keep the kids buying each issue because they can't wait to find out how it picks up from the last cliffhanger. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, this has a footnote to an issue of Strange Tales, the Nick Fury and Doctor Strange flip book, specifically the Nick Fury segment of that, where there's a little cameo from basically a villain who will be appearing in the Nick Fury issue, basically telling you, hey, if you want to see how this whole thing pans out, go read Strange Tales issue, I don't know, I think it was 146. So that's fun stuff.
It is, and what a wonderful opening for a segue into Strange Tales 146, which was also on our reading list. Let's dive right into that because of that tie-in that Tim alluded to just a moment ago. We covered in Tales of Suspense 78, you see Nick Fury come to Captain America and kind of warn him about the impending threat of them. And then in 79 through 81, you see Captain America kind of fighting the Red Skull portion of them. And here in Strange Tales 146, in the Nick Fury half anyway, you see Nick Fury kind of doing battle with the, I guess, the larger them at large, who, as we all know at this point, is AIM. And I thought it was kind of interesting that they kind of had that subplot bouncing forth across two books. I mean, it really feels like they're starting to play up the expansive nature of the Marvel Universe by having these things thread through multiple books. I don't know if it was a sales ploy back then or what, or even if it worked as a sales ploy, but it certainly makes it to feel like you're missing little chunks, especially if you were a kid who wasn't reading everything at this time. So,
and it's exactly the same creative team on both the Nick Fury and the Cap section. It's Stan Jack and Don Heck on inks.
It's almost like, yeah, like it's one big story unless you really have to get all of these things, you know, the Strange Tales, Nick Fury stuff and the Cap Tales of Suspense stuff to really get the full story. So, Todd, you mentioned the same creative team. What'd you make of this little one-off Nick Fury? I'll be honest. I thought the Captain America side of the story was much more interesting.
Yeah, much stronger, although I don't get tired of Cap telling Jasper Sitwell to shut up. I mean, of Nick Fury telling him to shut up.
I never knew that Jasper Sitwell was an actual like comics character until like this issue.
Oh yeah,
which is a creation for the MCU.
Yeah, and he's has no connection to. Alert! We do you get Dum Dugan and the rest of the. So this to me this art is a little bit more Don Heck than it is Jack Kirby. To be honest, if we look at the cat. Very strong Kirby. Very, very, very.
Yeah,
Kirby.
I think he was more thumbnails than full pencils on the Nick Fury Strange Tales segment. I think that was really Don Heck finishing. Looking at it now, I see the same thing.
Yeah, this seems a little skimmy. Like it was done very quickly. Although I do like the orange androids with the the horseshoe bald pattern and. You know, they almost have an option to them, but this is much weaker comparatively, and still waiting for Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. to hit the peaks that we know that it's going to hit.
It's coming with Steranko, I believe, in, you know, Steranko first pops up in 67, actually, and then we'll take on the book as a more more permanent basis a little bit after that. But yeah, I skimmed this one the same way Russell skimmed some of the Iron Man stuff. What about this one, Russell? Did it hold your attention, the Nick Fury portion of this?
Dear God, no. this was another example of the kind of Nick Fury story I really don't want to read. It is so dialogue heavy and so overloaded with exposition. And the thing is, the artwork is actually telling a lot of this story without all of that. If you're just, you know, paying attention to what's drawn on the page, you don't need all this. It's just, it's so bloated and it drags the whole thing's pacing way down. Will say though that I got a good laugh at the penis head monsters at the end, because what else are they going to look like? Look at them. They look like penises. And that's about the first time I actually like found myself somewhat entertained by this story. Don Heck's art actually is really great. It feels like it's finally coming into its own. Like I can start to pick out his art over Kirby's or Ditko's or anyone else. Like if I see his art on a book, I'm like, that's Don Heck. I can look at it just from a stylistic standpoint now. So that's good that we're getting there. I will give the story a little bit of credit though, because it feels like we're getting really into Nick Fury becoming more the secret agent type rather than just being the old grizzled soldier who's playing the whole fish out of water thing. It's like we're inching towards that, and I think once we get to the Steranko parts, of course he's going to like go fully into that. But I feel like the seeds of it are starting to sprout a little bit here.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's becoming less generic, I think, than we were when we were first introduced to Nick Fury, agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Tim, how did this stuff work for you?
All I will add to this is that I am struck by how much Don Heck slash Jack Kirby, whoever's Nick Fury, looks like David Hasselhoff. And this is before David Hasselhoff is really David Hasselhoff by some ways. And I'm like, huh, maybe they kind of got that one right.
From a visual standpoint.
Yeah.
The Hoff still could have worked. I stand by it had he been given more to work with.
He couldn't have read this art, this dialogue. This is not Hoffian.
No, not I just love that the Hoffian.
I wonder how we blasted Hambo. This is.
I don't know. I've watched David Hasselhoff have an argument with a cheeseburger. I think he could pull this off.
That's a great video.
Oh man. Well, Nick Fury wasn't all that was in this issue of Strange Tales that we read, as we also got to pop back over into the world of Doctor Strange, which we have all heaped praise upon, I should say, throughout this Marvel Age journey. And I gotta say, guys, this is another example of an outstanding Doctor Strange story, in my opinion, at least from a visual standpoint. As this might feature, and I could be wrong on this, so you know, call me out on social media, we'll send you a no prize. But I'm fairly sure this is the last Steve Ditko Doctor Strange for some time.
Yes, it is.
And we get to see a big throwdown between Dormammu and Eternity. But as one comics legend departs our Marvel Age journey, another comes on board, because this one, while it was edited by Stan Lee, it was scripted by then credited as Dennis O'Neill. So quite an interesting turn of events here in Strange Tales 146. I loved it. I think Eternity is one of my favorite character designs we've seen in the Marvel Universe to this point, and getting to see him unleash his full might upon Dormammu was pretty damned awesome, and something of an earned moment after we've seen Dormammu's impetulance just grow because he's been humbled over the course of the issues we've read. I freaking loved this. Russell, how'd you feel about it?
This was a lot of fun. This was one that gave us, like as you alluded to, gave us the big payoff moment between Dormammu and Eternity, something that felt like it's been built to for a while now, actually. It feels like it's been since we started reading Doctor Strange, honestly, that we've been getting to this point. And I agree with you. I think that Eternity's design is right on. That's just that's some fun stuff. But, man, can you imagine the kids that were tripping, like dropping acid and then reading this? My God, if they did it and then read this issue, the trip you're going to be on, I don't know if it's going to be good or bad, but it's going to be one that's going to leave an impression on you. One other thing that left an impression on me was this. Steve Ditko wants to go out on a very memorable note here, and boy, does he drop in like just some amazing stuff in all of this. It even has a little bit of that Kirby crackle thing going on, at least from my estimation. But there's one panel in particular. And I think I sent you guys a picture of it, but it's right on page 2, about halfway down the page, when the caption reads, "Summoning all his prowess, Dormammu penetrates 1,000 barriers undreamed of by man. A cosmos shudders as the delicate balance of its most inviolable laws is upset. An alarm pulses through the dark regions." And there in the panel is something that is Rosebudian in nature. Maybe a little sperm and egg going on.
It's like a George O'Keefe painting.
A bit. And it's like, this is none too subtle. And I could not help but set my tablet down while I proceeded to cackle to myself for about 10 minutes over this one little caption. Because it felt like Ditko and Stanley were totally on the same page with this, no matter their issues at the time. This just felt like one of those moments where they said, we really got to put something in there that's just so loaded with sexual innuendo that you can't possibly miss it. And this was the kind of on the nose comedy that I appreciate. So I like Stan Lee and Steve Ditko for doing that. But other than that, yes, absolutely outstanding story. And it's really one of the shorter Doctor Strange stories that we've read. It took me almost no time to go through this because it's basically a backup story to the Nick Fury stuff, which is unfortunate because this is the far superior story.
Yeah, and it's more artistically focused than probably any of the Doctor Strange stuff we've seen to this point. Not as much dialogue going on. Todd, I think you were going to jump in.
There were two full page art, or two splash pages in the middle, so that contributed to being a shorter read. But the ends get. We get an ending to the story, which rarely ever happens for us, with the serialization. But this is Stan and Steve, I guess it's Denny and Steve finishing it up and getting out. Everybody gets released. Clea is named. And, it's an actual ending to a story, which we very rarely see.
Absolutely. Tim, anything to add here on the Doctor Strange portion of Strange Tales 146?
That's right. At last, the silver-haired girl gets a name. It's Clea. We'll be seeing a good bit
of... Or
Clea, I guess you could say it that way. I never thought of
that. Rhymes with Flea.
Flea, Clea, Clea. Anyway, more of her in the years to come. To me, the Doctor Strange fight, such as it was with Dormammu, that felt like sort of the blow-off of a long-term wrestling feud, mm-hmm. in that they've already kind of done their best work together. And this is here to advance us onto the next thing, which is Dormammu and Eternity squaring
off. Ric Flair, you're a hell of a man.
Thank you for that. That one splash page of Dormammu kind of suspended within Eternity is gorgeous.
It's amazing.
Talk about that is on page
so good.
The page six. Yeah, page 6, where it kind of looks like Dormammu is also standing there full spread eagle in front of Eternity, like, I'm going to defeat you with my dick. And then
well, it's weird the way it's composed. I mean, Dormammu has his back to us, so it's a little bit hee-hee, but the way that it's rendered is just, I mean, I kind of had to stop and just admire this page for a while.
It's tremendously drawn. I love all of the little – there is so much detail factored into this. So it makes me think, man, this had to have taken forever to actually get right. And trying to wrap my head around the idea of imagining this and then putting it to paper is really difficult. Mm-hmm. So it speaks to the tremendous amount of creativity that Steve Ditko had.
Yep.
Absolutely. Well – something else we had on our reading list for the second part of 1967 was a book that we haven't delved into much lately, and that, of course, is Tales to Astonish. But praise God it wasn't Ant-Man and the Wasp. Instead, Tales to Astonish at this point had become a book that was co-starring Namor and the Hulk in two distinct separate stories, much like Iron Man and Captain America in Tales of Suspense or Nick Fury and Doctor Strange in Strange Tales. Can't say this was overly impactful or left any kind of real impression on me, but I guess it is good to get a little taste of what exactly a Namor and Resurrected Hulk solo story looks like. Tim, what'd you make of this little sampling of Namor and the Hulk?
Very little. The Namor story leading us off, the old submariner, as the manager would say, or I would perhaps say as well, it seems like it's coming in at the end of this kind of long-running saga of the submariner. That's a different thing. But anyway, there's this sort of long-running story that we have not really covered on this program, where he's kind of at odds with his warlord, Krang. Mm-hmm. And this is what I think occupied so much of his time that kept him out of the spotlight in some of the other series we have been looking at. He was notably absent, you'll recall, in the Fantastic Four wedding issue annual. So anyway, we get to see what he's been up to. This is Gene Colan art.
Yes.
You should stress under
Adam Austin. Yep.
Yep. Yep. So it says credited to Adam Austin. That is Gene Colan. So there's that. Then the Hulk story is of even less consequence. I don't know who Scott Edward is, who is the credited artist on that book. Sounds like another pseudonym, but I'm just not sure. I can't really find anything on that. I know I'm kind of not talking about the stories themselves, but that's because I don't have a lot to say about it. That Hulk story doesn't get interesting until the last panel, when apparently the Executioner shows up as the Hulk is flung into this far future world. It kind of just washes over you.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know, man.
So apparently Scott Edward is Gil Kane.
Really?
Able to discern from the Google machine.
Okay. Well, that kind of works. That tracks. Okay.
But he didn't. He was quickly Gil Kane. Like, there are later issues of this book in 66 that he gets to call himself by his name.
Mm-hmm. And he was working at DC at the same time, so
yeah.
That would make sense to conceal his identity.
Green Lantern, most notably, I believe.
Wow, I did not. Okay. Very good. Thank you, Todd.
You're welcome. But yeah, Hulk has this big head look, and it is. There's not a whole lot going on, but it is fun to see the Executioner pop up at the very end. There's not otherwise a lot going on. You get to see more of the two personalities. We don't see Banner or Rick Jones. Rick Jones is apparently being held hostage somewhere and not playing a prominent part in this issue, if I recall. But thank God for small favors. And Hulk talks about how he and Banner are totally different individuals, different personalities, different personas, different 100% as though he doesn't even exist or acknowledge that they're the same physical being. So they're evolved, but he's still talking my preferences.
Gotcha. Russell, what about you, man? What'd you make of this Namor Hulk co-starring piece?
You know, as inconsequential as it all is, I felt like the Namor stuff would feel pretty at home in modern Aquaman, honestly. Just the happenings of it, the way that Namor becomes like fully king of Atlantis. He winds up, you know, banishing Krang after like, kind of giving him a royal beatdown, which I actually kind of enjoyed that scene. Artwork on this was really great to me. I mean, it's a really quick story, and it feels like it's one of those things that could be wrapped up in like the back half of something. It certainly feels like an ending, or like it's setting up for the next chapter of Submariner by kind of wiping the board a little bit. Not the best thing that I've ever read, but actually this kind of keeps me on that same path of becoming more of a Namor fan than I ever thought I would. I've enjoyed this evolution of him from at first being a villain to now kind of adopting a more heroic stance. So I'm kind of looking forward to whatever comes next. The Hulk stuff, as has been pointed out, is not good. It is, even though you've taken away the more annoying elements of Hulk's story by removing Rick Jones from it, somehow things got worse. It's a little like what happened when they killed Carl on Walking Dead. Like things should have gotten better. It makes sense that things would get better after that. You've removed the most annoying element of the show. But somehow they found a way to continue shitting the bed. And that's exactly what this whole exercise feels like. Even though I found the idea of sending Hulk into the far future to be pretty interesting, as Tim rightly points out, this story just prods along and doesn't have one interesting thing really happening in it until the Executioner shows up at the end. And all that did was make me want to go read Thor comics. So if that was the goal, then success. If it was to make me intrigued to read more of this Hulk, I don't give a shit. So that's where I feel like this issue left me, was in a place of, hey, that Namor stuff was okay, and this Hulk, nobody cares. I wouldn't pay for this.
Yeah, this issue is evidently on our reading list just to give us a sense of what the Hulk and Namor's shared comic was like, which is what Tales to Astonish has been for some time now. And we haven't covered that in this particular format yet. And I got to say, if this is representative of what that book is like, then yikes. I mean, the best Namor stuff this year is really in his crossover with Iron Man over in Tales of Suspense. So yep. I don't know if you guys read those segments, but they have a nice little like reissue dust up that is kind of worth your time.
Yeah, with Krang too, and Dorma.
Yeah,
with Krang.
Yeah, because it starts with Krang and Dorma showing up, and Iron Man chases him back into the sea, and then Namor is angry that Iron Man has denied him his opportunity at revenge. So.
I have a nice little slugfest. That also Gene Colan art, and a very official crossover starts in Tales of Suspense, concludes in Tales to Astonish, an issue which was not on our list. So
yeah, 80.
Things are getting very tangled in this year, I feel like, with the crossovers and the anthology series and the split books and all that stuff.
Yeah, if I can comment on the reading list itself, I think he wants snapshots and maybe notable moments, but full stories for the most part we're not necessarily tracking here. Right. We did it with Fantastic Four, we did it with Spider-Man, but here we're getting maybe just a bit of this story. Oh, this is what's going on. Here's how the art is different. Here's how the character has evolved a bit. I do. That Colan art on with Vince Coletta on the Submariner port, Russell was saying, very strong, big figures. The art tells the story a little bit more, being this to the Hulk half of it. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty strong too. But I wouldn't necessarily be buying this book if I were buying comics in 66. I'd probably just be picking up Spider-Man and Fantastic Four, probably.
And X-Men.
Yeah. And X-Men, right, which
if I could find it.
Which there was no X-Men on our reading list for this year, which was a little weird. No X-Men for us to read in 1966. Well, that's as good a time as any to kind of take a break for right now. And when we come back on the other side, we're going to talk some Daredevil, some Avengers, and most notably, I would argue, some Thor here in 1966. Thor. So stick with us. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back after all. he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceForNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceForNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hi there. Have you recently gone through a crisis? Did you find out your friends had been lying to you for years to cover up something they did? Have you discovered that one of your bitter enemies might actually be three people? Were you seemingly killed by a new god only to find yourself quantum leaping through time until you make it back to the present? Was your entire reality wiped out in a cosmic battle between two godlike beings only to be reborn, destroyed, and reborn again? Then join me, Russell Sellers, and my special guests as we help you manage your post-crisis life in DC Post-Crisis Management, a limited monthly series starting in September. We can't promise you closure, but we will try to avoid destroying your hometown and turning you into a homicidal maniac who wipes out time.
Welcome back to our discussion on part two of 1966 in the Marvel Universe. I, of course, am Nick Duke. Alongside me are the Sarcastic Four. And we're going to pick back up our discussion by diving over to the man without fear, Daredevil himself. And we're going to take a look at Daredevil 18 that featured the debut of the Gladiator, one of the more enduring Daredevil villains. And I don't know that there's been a more inconsistent title across the first several years of this project than Daredevil. It seems like every issue is either great or a pile of steaming dog shit. And unfortunately, this is a pile of steaming dog shit, in my opinion. Tim Capel, as our listeners will hear in just a couple of weeks, you hold Daredevil in very high esteem, but I am imagining you didn't hold this issue in quite as high an esteem.
So this issue is challenging my notion that Daredevil is never not good. We may need to put an addendum on that. I will say I was somewhat enhanced when I read this issue, which perhaps enhanced the issue as well. Because while this is complete ridiculous nonsense, I sort of got a kick out of it, and that's because, if you'll notice, we mentioned Denny back then, Dennis O'Neill. He scripts this one. And
I did not notice this time, so
well, good call. Yeah, what happened is
he covers for Stan's on Vacation.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's drawn by John Romita.
And we've got John Romita on art. So how can you – it seems like how can you go wrong with this combination?
Well
– just sort of everything goes wrong.
This one, it goes off the rails really fast, doesn't it?
It does.
From the first page.
Yeah.
I did get the sense that this is a Stan Lee plot, and Denny O'Neill is sort of almost clowning on the plot that he has to script here, and that he's not earnest in the way that Stan would be about something like this. So it is a little bit more self-aware and campy for what it's going for. But that said, it's still a nonsense plot. So I guess I take it what's happening here is that Foggy thinks that Karen thinks that he is Daredevil. And rather than trying to dissuade her from this notion, he actually wants her to think he's Daredevil, which I didn't realize until, I don't know, I guess when he purchases the costume from the Gladiator. He runs this costume shop, right? So I'm like, yeah. Oh, no, wait, he wants her to think that he's Daredevil. So I laughed and laughed at this.
Apparently Spider-Man told him it would be a good idea.
Yes.
I don't know if you read that.
I got kind of confused in the wording of it as he was talking about this idea. I was like, so you're going to fool her into not thinking you're Daredevil and not try to throw, oh no, you actually do want her to think you're, yeah, okay. That's a stupid ass plot. And did you notice that as this went along, Foggy sounded less and less like a guy in love and more like a guy who, if we're putting this, I guess, in modern context, was really just trying to get up Karen's skirt. Like that's... Like that's how it came off to me, because I mean,
oh yeah,
like if you're gonna dupe this woman into thinking you're Daredevil, which by the way, I love the fact that everybody remarks on how they didn't think Daredevil was so flabby.
Right,
that's the best. They were like, absolutely the best.
Those two cops standing next to him at the end, they were like, "Huh, I never realized how fat he is." I was like, yes, Foggy is a flabby ass man.
Oh, and the whole thing about Gladiator, like, what the hell?
He's vaguely Russian, isn't he? Like, did you naturally read him as like some kind of crossbreed between a Russian and an Austrian, like I did?
I kept reading him in Borat voice.
Close enough. That's vaguely nothing. So, it's just weird. Like this whole
so help me out with my Gladiator continuity here. Is there a Gladiator 2 that is the Melvin Potter we all know and love, or is this Melvin Potter?
I have no idea.
I think this is Melvin Potter, or supposed to be.
Oh man.
Well, if he's
very nice.
Well, if he's Mr. Potter, then we have to read him like that.
He's a scurvy little spotter.
That's the only way to be entertained about this issue is to just brutally make fun of it as you go along. I mean, just MST3K this thing to death, because that's what it deserves.
So why doesn't Daredevil confront Foggy and say, what the fuck are you doing, Foggy Nelson?
Right?
Do this again. I will threaten you with bodily harm. Meanwhile, stay away from
Carol.
Because that would be against the bro code. He understands that Foggy is just trying to get a little action, and you don't. That would be a grossly excessive cock block, I feel.
There's one.
One doesn't date someone one works with. You don't shit where you eat.
In the 1960s Marvel Universe, you exclusively shit where you eat. That is the only way.
Yeah.
It's firmly on your dinner table.
That is the Mad Men way, and apparently that show was more documentary than entertainment. But there is another problematic aspect to this issue is that apparently Karen is the dumbest person walking the planet because she – this whole game of duping her just continues. But it's one little piece of dialogue that just made me throw up my hands and be like, okay, this is too far. When she goes back
she cries.
She does that. She does that. Much to Greg Phillips' joy, she cries. But there's also the part where she goes back to the office because she thinks Matt's working late and all the lights are off. And she's like, oh, he must have gone home early because there are no lights on in his office. And I threw my hands up like, really, Stan? Really?
He's blind.
He's fucking blind. And you're going to talk about that. Oh, there's no light on the office. He must have gone home. Did you? What the fuck? Never mind. I'm just hands on face.
Somehow, I'm not as dramatic as I'd imagined as Foggy suits up and emerges from the shadows. Foggy seems to be having difficulties. If he ever impersonates me in public, my reputation will be shot. As Daredevil just watches from afar. Gladiator's getting pissed because Foggy is late for their little meet cute.
Now I want to see this in the MCU. Between Foggy, Daredevil, like fat Foggy as Daredevil. And fat Blue Beetle from the Wahaha era, like teaming up to go on like fat superheroic adventures. And even they could bring in Fat Man the Human Flying Saucer.
Yes.
If they got a little froggy about it. But
there's a deep cut.
Gladiator just taunting.
Just you wait. Just you wait. Oh, Jesus, this issue.
And the sad thing is, as someone who's read a lot of this early Daredevil, it's going to get even more like, what the fuck, as soon as Mike Murdock is introduced.
Oh, yeah.
And seemingly will not go away for like 2 years. Stan
was expecting Mike Murdock to
show up. Mike Murdock was going to work and finally gave up on it after what felt like an eternity. So
should have just fought your mama and been done with it.
I think we've sufficiently buried Daredevil here in 1966.
Deservedly so.
But let's move on.
Okay, here comes the man without fear. As the real Daredevil thinks to himself, now there's a remark worthy of Spider-Man. I wonder if I sound that cornball.
Do you notice that he stops talking and all of his, like, everything Daredevil speak goes into just the thought bubbles after that? After he says, man, I'm just going to stop talking and fight. and I was like, there you go. You're hitting on the ideas of what makes Daredevil work. Even though this issue is just pure dog shit, you're getting there. There's little things there that are going to pick up and work really well later on for writers who will follow you. And I think that maybe they thought about that and said, maybe this guy shouldn't speak all the time.
It's not exactly Denny O'Neill making, I was going to say shit out of Shinola. That's kind of the other way around.
This ain't Batman era Denny O'Neill.
He seems to get it.
But he's operating. He's not being given the freedom to create his own story.
No, that's true.
Essentially being like, write dialogue for these stupid plots that Stan's coming up with. And doesn't actually care about enough the script himself. You know,
he gets that it's silly, and he's still trying to give you something at least entertaining. And
so maybe it's him I should blame for that whole lights on in the office comment.
Well, yeah, it was his page.
Yeah.
And I don't mean Karen.
I appreciate your punnage, Todd.
Man.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, another book that's been very inconsistent, much like Daredevil to this point, has been Avengers. And we're going to talk about a couple of issues of Avengers here in 1966, the first of which featured the Avengers in a showdown against the character who has kind of become the only real Marvel Universe at large villain, and that is Dr. Doom. Filling a central role here as he lures the Avengers to Latveria by promising to reveal that Wanda and Pietro's parents or mother are still alive and living in Latveria. So quite an interesting turn of events here. Our first real glimpse at the Avengers since the lineup shakeup in 65. And I have to say, while not outstanding by any stretch, I kind of think this lineup is more interesting, at least at this point in time, than the classic like Big Four lineup was. Am I wrong for thinking that, Tim?
No, there is more potential to this lineup in that these guys are not as fleshed out as your heavy hitters in Thor and Iron Man and, for better or worse, Giant Man and the Wasp, or Ant-Man and the Wasp, whichever.
Or Goliath and the Wasp, depending
Goliath
on
and the Wasp.
What we're calling him at any given moment.
So there is more to be exploited with them, to give them proper characters, to see how they interact, to have some real tension within this team. That said, I did not think that Quicksilver parked in front of the television watching the Ed Sullivan Show is quite in keeping with the characterization I would come to know from him. So, I mean, these
right,
guys...
Vanda, I am watching Topo Gigio. It's Senor Vences. Yeah, no, not me either, Tim.
They've got some ways to go still. But the character dynamics, yes, are more interesting with this bunch. Cap's kooky quartet. Bit of a ridiculous premise to this, too, with Dr. Doom sitting down to write a letter. I guess he's practiced his calligraphy, not unlike Magneto with his skywriting. In any case, his penmanship must be convincing enough to pass for that of a long-lost relative. I mean, I guess this is someone whose existence they don't know of, but they are taken by this letter and are going to travel to Latveria to meet with this person. And everyone, it kind of just slipped their minds that the sovereign ruler of Latveria is Dr. Doom. They all just go, oh, that's right. Shit.
Yeah, they rush into Latveria and they're like, oh, man, what have we done?
Oh, what a boner.
Yes. I'm glad somebody else realized that. And it's
that's
like, huh.
Great humor.
It's like, here's this evil dictator, like one of the worst supervillains in the world, who is the ruler of this country. Oh, yeah, we totally glossed over that fact. Let's just go anyway.
And I love at the beginning, Dr. Doom, like, clearly establishing where the Avengers are on the pecking order as it relates to the Fantastic and the Marvel Universe. He's like, yeah, I'll get to them, but I have to show them that I'm worthy of fighting them by knocking off these assholes first.
Yeah, the B-list superhero team.
My God, even Marvel is referring to the Avengers as the B-list.
At the point, yeah. That'll be something to track. It's kind of interesting. Is like the Avengers today always get compared to the Justice League, but I feel like that wasn't really accurate for so much of the publishing history that I'm interested to see that, when that kind of becomes the thing. I mean, does it not really become a thing until Brian Michael Bendis, or is that like when does that happen?
Avengers hit their Justice League Detroit era very early.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they started out as kind of the all-star team. It was the collection of solo heroes that weren't the that weren't already in a book together kind of thing. And they hit their Justice League Detroit era, and functionally their role in the Marvel Universe is analogous to the Justice League, but in terms of their lineup, no, it's not until Bendis comes along when it actually they decide, all right, we're going to put all our most popular characters on this one team. It was not that for the better part of its history, no.
Gotcha.
Well, some of the political stuff continues in this one too, and I just don't appreciate that. It's the Avengers versus fake news.
Mm.
This news is coming directly from Dr. Doom. He is telling these people that the Avengers are their enemy. What's not to believe? I mean, he's the most honest guy in the world. I mean, it's coming straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
If you're getting your news from just one source, Dr. Doom.
Latverian News
Network. What are you supposed to do?
Yeah. It's like, this is what you believe. And but all that said, this is
well,
not,
especially when little Timmy needs an operation and there's an impenetrable
right.
dome,
yes,
negative zone.
That aspect.
Well,
mm-hmm. You know, this yeah. one.
We got to take care of the cripple. As he was referred to throughout.
Yes,
throughout
he
this
was.
Issue. The lame, unnamed civilian child. He might have had a name, and I don't remember.
And you know, if
I
this
do
had been
appreciate.
The, if this had been the modern era, though, since this is an issue 25, there would totally have been some kind of like extra packaging or some padding to make this issue even longer, and its price point would have been higher. But you know, neither here nor there. I'm just saying that back then, issue 25 didn't seem like that big of a deal because it's really not. This is not a big deal.
No.
Kind of issue, even though it is the first time that the Avengers have fought Dr. Doom. By the time you get to the end of it, it's like, well, all right then. It's like there was
yeah,
that.
Done in one, spun yeah. the wheels. I appreciated the 9 panels, the Fantastic Four were told that they couldn't interfere. Like, they were stuck. Avengers have no problem getting into Latveria, landing, no problem, and Fantastic Four are hung up and
stopped at the gate.
Yeah, to me is preferable to the original team, just because Hawkeye here always. What's Hawkeye's? Is he an archer? No, he's a counterbalance for Cap. That's pretty much all Hawkeye does here. Oh, although he really wants Wanda, as apparently all men in the MCU do.
Yes.
So,
well, he still called it the MCU. There you go.
I did it again. The Marvel Universe, the early Marvel Universe of 1966.
When you say MCU, you of course mean the Marvel Comics Universe, but
Marvel Comics Universe.
Absolutely.
Well, and she's only got eyes for Captain America, it would seem. And
or Pietro.
We're a few years off from that, but I don't know. Some of these subplots, I don't know that they really go anywhere, but they're sort of interesting to watch play out and to play like what if with some of this stuff. And I would agree with your point on Hawkeye. He's kind of the most compelling new member of this team. And I love the little barbs he throws at Cap, you know, calling him Methuselah and all this stuff. Just it's very Hawkeye right out of the gate, you know.
The only other things I think of note before we move on, I think, are Don Heck is full-fledged penciler. There's no Kirby layouts whatsoever. And there's
he's
a bit
great.
Where, yeah, he does just fine. There is a bit where they talk about the time travel paradoxes and Kang and the Pharaoh and Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
More Stan Lee arguing with himself over what he wants to do with this.
It's exactly what it is.
Has no idea yet, but yet another gift for a later writer to determine. But you guys mentioned the Hawkeye pining after Wanda thing. That goes out the door as soon as the Black Widow is back on the table in issue 29, as we see here, over the reveal that she's still alive. She is making her return to plague the Avengers, and she has put together her own little evil B-list super team of Power Man and the Swordsman to take on the Avengers, and predictably, it does not go well for that B-list villainous team. You get Hawkeye kind of sort of torn, I guess, for a moment before very quickly making the choice to side with the Avengers, but I don't know. This one felt more paint by the numbers and didn't do as much for me as the Doctor Doom issue did. Todd, what about you?
Yeah, I agree. Looking back, 25, we kind of ripped it as we were reading it, but there's more there than this more two-dimensional. Although, notice that Hank and Jan are back with the team, at least in a guest starring role here, but Hank gets stuck at 10 feet. So they're trying to do something compelling with them. I do like that they're kind of
wedging Natasha into more of a traditional supervillainess, which is cool, but it's still very, very Red Menace, Red Scare kind of thing with the I don't know who her boss is there. He's actually an Asian character. If I look at it, they're tying that in. Nothing going on there. Power Man, who is that? I used to think Power was Luke Cage, but apparently not. Power Man is not Luke Cage. Who is he at this point? He is a character.
I'm pretty sure this is Eric Yostin, who will become Atlas of the Thunderbolts. I think.
So, I have to go back and read that first Thunderbolts issue by Kurt Busiek, which is really, really good. I just don't remember many of the characters other than, what's his name? Is it Zemo?
Swordsman. Oh,
no. Oh, and Moonstone are in that issue. That team.
Are we talking Thunderbolts now? We Thunderbolts, can talk Thunderbolts.
Yeah. We can talk Thunderbolts, but we have to wait until
it would
about
be more
5 years
from now. It would be more interesting than this issue. I do agree.
Yeah. They have Janet Van Dyne here. It's where she appears about the same age as Hank.
Well, at least
yeah,
that.
For the most part. I mean, she doesn't seem like she's a 12-year-old girl.
No.
That's true. They have her up.
Audrey Hepburn gloves. And
that's one thing I guess you should address is the weird, like, what exactly are they doing with Hank Pym at this point? He was Ant-Man, then he was Giant-Man, now he's Goliath. Like, why? What exactly is the idea behind constantly changing the name for him?
It feels like they just have no idea what they want to do with him, so they're throwing shit at a wall to see what sticks. And that's all that you can really say for him. But, I mean, being stuck at 10 feet, yeah, there are going to be a lot of disadvantages there, but I think that it might be helping him in one particular area.
Right, the big dick.
Yeah, imagine the movies.
Yes, I'm pretty sure he's got that BDE going on. And, that's for you, Tim.
Thank you.
And I'm absolutely certain that Janet will get over this whole business of him being, you know, gargantuanly tall.
Can she get over it?
I'm gonna say as soon as he comes out of that costume, she might be like, you know what, I'm fine with this. this all seems to be working out in my favor. And I know you guys weren't as high on this one as I was, but I actually wound up kind of liking this one and liking it more than I like 25. If only for the Commissioner Gordon, I mean Dr. Carlson, coming in to save Giant Man. I mean, sorry, Goliath. Good God, the whole round and round we go business of this issue of Avengers in general. But overall, I kind of dug the intrigue there with Hawkeye and Black Widow. I thought that was a bit more interesting to me than it was in their initial encounters with each other. And I will say, as much as I like the Don Heck art, I don't think anybody has yet really figured out how to illustrate speedster powers, because every time he's drawing Quicksilver doing his like speed business, he's just a silhouetted figure with as lines.
Yeah, just a big green line.
It's a weird rendering of the power. So, you know, we haven't quite got there yet with speedster illustrations. And it does seem, is it just me or is Scarlet Witch's costume getting skimpier?
Oh, it's definitely doing that.
Yeah, it's shrinking a bit. But I did like I also like the dynamic between Cap and Hawkeye, and I felt like it actually reached a really good spot at the end of this issue. Like they both seem to have reach this point where, all right, we've done the adversarial thing where we're bouncing back and forth with each other. Now we actually feel like we're going to genuinely be friends going forward. So I like the team building aspect of it. So this has got something. This has something to offer, even if it is a bit on the ridiculous side too.
You know what? I'm actually kind of with you, Russell. You know, there's a lot that doesn't work. Granted, yes, but. Sure. For an Avengers issue and what we've seen of this series up to this point, this to me was one of the better issues we have read. And I just dug the sort of intersecting interpersonal drama here that felt more like my Avengers, so to speak.
Yeah.
Lots of characters in play with, you know, different sort of equally compelling subplots going on. They have what we are led to believe are somewhat rich interior lives. And that approach, I just thought, is well suited to this plot, which was kind of divide and conquer by this team of somewhat more villains, I'll grant you.
But their idea was kind of solid for a minute.
It was kind of solid for a minute. And, I mean, Todd, you're going to call blasphemy here, but you know what this reminded me of? It was sort of a almost first draft of something like Roger Stern's Avengers Under Siege in the 80s, where the Masters of Evil take out the whole team in somewhat similar fashion. So while this can't really measure up to that, it's the same idea in play. And, you know, evoking that better story sort of worked on me here. Some good action. Yeah, the Don Heck art, which I've not been totally fond of up to this point, I thought worked pretty well here. And sure, seeing a future Thunderbolt as well. So it's all these, I know I'm talking about better comics and better stories in years to come that this is reminding me of, and that's maybe not fair criticism, but what can I say? It worked for me.
Interesting that we're kind of divided on this one. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't terrible by any stretch of the imagination, but I guess I just found the external threats to be so paint by the numbers, and
they were
just kind of boring. But you're right, there were some nice interpersonal dynamics, and the Hawkeye Cat dynamic, like Todd said earlier, it at least gives Hawkeye a point, which is to serve as that counterbalance to Cap's Boy Scouty nature. Even though I think it's cool in these two issues, you see Cap even rising to anger and threatening to throttle Hawkeye points or whatever.
Cap's beating some ass here,
Yes, and good for he and good for Wanda. But in any event, also on our reading list for this time was Thor. That's right, not Journey into Mystery, but Thor, who has finally had become the breastular character of his own book. And we get to see here issues 131 through 133 as Thor goes a little cosmic. Now, the story opens and we get this weird subplot with Tana Nile, who has come to colonize Earth, and that whole aspect of the story, pretty stupid, not very entertaining, but it sets Thor off on an adventure through the cosmos that will eventually result in the introduction of Ego the Living Planet, but more importantly, gives Jack Kirby an opportunity to flex his muscles as it relates to interesting designs of locales and characters. Well, when Thor gets out into the cosmos. So predictably, I loved all this because I'm a massive Thor mark, but especially once we get to the Ego stuff late in this three-part story, it is humming from both a storytelling and artistic standpoint. Todd, back me up on this. Kirby here is showing out, in my opinion.
Yeah, as soon as they get into outer space, Kirby jumps up a notch with all the spaceships, all the alien technology, and all the stuff he gets to do to create the Ego, both Ego himself and then the biosphere and the creatures that he creates. I loved this too. Did not like the Rigel aspect, or the Rigelians, however you pronounce it. That stuff was just kind of a means to an end. And they stick around up until we meet Ego, and that takes over. So nice little three-issue stretch here. Kirby, to me, is the star. The characters are developing a bit. Jane Foster and the weirdos that she meets, who are apparently working for, spoiler alert, the High Evolutionary. Is that right?
Yes.
The High AF Evolutionary, I believe.
So, yeah, one of Tim's favorite is that character. So new stuff it will be coming. It's interesting, you know, the serialized nature of the story. We start out with a look at the Thor-Hercules camaraderie, And then this kind of progresses into this Thor in space story. And along the way, he gets permission from Odin to marry Jane Foster. But is it Don Blake marrying Jane Foster? Is it Thor marrying Jane Foster? We don't see Don Blake at all. Thank God for that. So they're kind of finding their way as far as the Thor. This is classic Kirby all the way. I have to think this is more Stan than – or more Jack than Stan, to be honest, just from everything we know. And that Jane Foster subplot with the two weirdos in Europe is something, isn't it?
I didn't know what to make of that.
She's certainly a unique situation.
She's having dinner with Jordan Duncan. She's about to – she's about to meet, I guess, the high AF evolutionary, but I don't remember these guys in connection with this character. Perhaps they are.
If she's having dinner with Jordan Duncan, we know that her European excursion will only last 2 weeks.
Oh. They're good.
I hate Hog Mountain. Shame on Hog Mountain. Someday you'll go to Hog Mountain.
Not unlike Wondegore Mountain. Oh.
That's where they're supposedly going.
What's...
Thor, the book, has stepped up because you're getting the famous Kirby collages now.
Yeah.
That you only would see in Fantastic Four.
That first panel of Ego revealed. That big
fly thing. Yep. What a page.
That was awesome. Absolutely chilling.
Yes, what? It was great, man. And even before that, was the panels leading up to it where they're just kind of wading through the biosphere or whatever. That's cool stuff, dude. That is peak Kirby, in my opinion. Russell, go ahead, Todd. Sorry.
Well, just that first bit of Ego looked a little bit like Stan.
It did.
Yeah, a little bit. Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about that.
I didn't think of that, yeah.
Russell, you haven't really had a chance to weigh in too much on this one so far. What did you make of this three-part Thor story?
This was fucking brilliant.
Yep.
Every bit of this, including the colonizer Nile stuff, and I'll tell you why. Because at first, I was with you, Nick, that part was just weird and seemed really stupid and out of place. And I thought at first, when it got to that part, I was like, oh no, please bring Hercules back. I was enjoying that part. The stuff in Asgard was great. Why aren't we still doing that? Where the hell is this going? This sucks. But the payoff of it. Because this little alien girl claims some colonization right through her planet's people that since Earth is uncharted, she can colonize and claim it as her own because there are no rules on it. And this is all played very seriously at the beginning. You're thinking, oh my God, this is going to be the big antagonist of this story. And oh shit, this is going to be terrible. And then, of course, they flip it and say, nope, Thor has gone out into space to try and shut down all this business, but in order to turn off the cosmic lock or whatever it is that she's put around the planet and is slowly pulling it out of orbit, he's got to do something for them. He's got to go into the biosphere, the dark galaxy, or the dark universe, whatever they called it. And
the dark universe.
Universe. He has to go into that, and thus we meet Ego and go through that business, which was beautifully rendered, epic storytelling. And that's where, you know, the story really sings. But the underappreciated part of this is that colonizer Nile now thinks of herself as the ruler of Earth, the unchallenged ruler of this planet. So she just goes out into the street in her full alien form, encounters police officers who just think she's some crazy person, and they take her down to the precinct. She never actually gets to demonstrate her powers because by the time that's going to happen, Thor has already succeeded and helped the planet Rigel out. They've revoked her claim and turned off all of her abilities to harm the planet. So now she just looks like a crazy person. And I found all of that to be immensely entertaining, that this was suddenly flipped from being this hugely menacing character to now being nothing but played for laughs. And it shows that Thor indeed can be funny as hell when it needs to be, when this book needs to be. It can be that. And I absolutely love that aspect of it. right up there with all of the incredible action pieces that are thrown throughout this story. This is by far maybe my favorite thing that we've read yet. This has cemented Thor in my mind as must-read comics every time. And not only that, we have to talk about the backups. We have to talk about the Tales of Asgard, because, oh my God, as present as Thor is in all those stories, Ballstag is the show.
Yeah.
Ballstag beating back the barbarians with his girth, with his gut, is one of the greatest panels in the history of comics. Thank you, Jack Kirby, for this wonderful gift.
Leading with his stomach at all times.
Yes. And his dialogue is some of the best that I have ever read. It is
Volstagg needs to go on like a Viking bear cruise one day and just see how much action he can rack up over the course of like 4 days.
Dude.
Oh man.
Dude, he would wreck shop. There would be there would be nothing left.
Yeah. Well, shout out to my friend Aaron George, who is unlikely to listen to this show, but maybe I will prompt him and he will check it out. Volstagg is based on the Shakespearean character of Falstaff, and big gregarious, eats everything, is a lover of everything. He loves all, and just this larger than life, literally, character. And the Warriors Three are great. I've always been kind of a closet fan of Hogan.
Oh, he's good. He's good in this too.
Yeah, I love the Warriors Three as a concept. Like, they all kind of work, especially when they are united. But if you have to go with just one of them, clearly Volstagg is the standout.
Yes.
Tim, you haven't had a chance to weigh in too much on this this Thor story and or the backups. What you got for us on Thor 131 through 133?
I will say, boy, the Rigelians, they're not one of Kirby's more memorable cosmic race creations, I guess, for good reason. And they sort of have their heads up their asses, don't they? Really selling old Earth 616 short and underestimating Thor. And the funny thing here is that Tana Nile, after she claims her dominion over the Earth, they say, okay, that's fine. It's uncatalogued. It's just this little backwater planet, and we're going to send an inspection team down. And she tries to say, no, don't do that. It might provoke a fight. We don't need that. Oh, well, you forget that we are invincible, so that won't matter. We're going to proceed with the mission. And they kind of get their asses handed to them by Thor, as Russell pointed out, which was, quite a lot to take in and enjoy. That said, I do still want their entire homeworld and civilization to be devoured by Galactus. I hate these characters. but fortunately, they are sidelined pretty quickly, and we get to the meat of this, which is Ego. And holy shit, if there is one single panel of art that is probably the favorite I've seen up to this point, it is that photo collage at the end of issue 132, the full reveal of Ego. My word. That's just on another level completely. Just stunning. We get in a year other than 1966, other than the coming of Galactus having occurred earlier in this year, or that we have covered earlier in this year, you might see this story talked about more. So it's a little bit unfortunate that we get this in the same year, but at the same time, all the more impressive, since this is all just from the mind of Kirby. And I just sit in awe, basically. So I don't think I love this quite as much as Russell. I thought the resolution to the Ego thing was a little bit too neat and pat. And Nick, maybe you can help me out here. It almost seems like Thor summoned like a spell. I mean, I know he was doing his whole God of Thunder act, but he incites a little incantation, and it just seemed like that trick wouldn't work on something like Ego, who is his entire own environment. Okay, yeah, you're going to hit him with some bad weather. Well,
right.
He's a
ego. Ego is definitely going to come into play later, and so I've always kind of read it as Ego was just biding his time and was like, "All right, well, you want to fuck around? Give me a minute to collect my shit." And then he comes back in fairly short order, from what I can recall, anyway. So
I mean, okay. Between Ego, Eternity, and Galactus, they're thinking big here.
Yes.
There is lots to love coming up, just from the basic setup that we've been given here. This was, sorry, Tim. This is tremendous.
No, I'm done. No, you're good.
I can't wait to see what's coming up. I mean, we've had such a huge year of introductions, and I don't necessarily want to say they saved the best one for last, but I will say that Thor story was the best story I think I've read out of all of 1966.
Wow. And that's an excellent segue, because now that brings it into to our reading list. But because this is our last episode covering 1966, we're going to dive in to some of our year-end awards. And remember, the issues we covered during our previous episode on 1966 are, of course, eligible as well. And just as a reminder, those were The Amazing Spider-Man 31 through 33 and 39 through 40, as well as Fantastic Four 46 through 53. And we're going to start off tonight. Let it not be said that I, as a host, do not listen to my fellow members of the Sarcastic Four. And I'm going to do something Todd Weber requested. Guys, I know this is short notice. I didn't warn you beforehand. Give me your cover of 1966. And I'll start with Todd, since he requested it.
That's a very good request to spring upon me. I'm going to go with Amazing Spider-Man 33, the final chapter, iconic Spidey beneath the water and machinery. You will hear more about that issue in a few moments, I'm sure. But I think I'm going to still go with that cover. I also enjoy the cover of 39, Amazing Spider-Man, with the Green Goblin towing a maskless Peter Parker. First time we got a look at John Romita Sr.'s art. So I think those two, but this man, this monster, third place choice for me at Fantastic Four 51. There were some good covers from this second half as well, but I'm going to stick with those three, and Amazing Spider-Man 33 gets my pick for cover.
I will give Russell and Tim a few more moments to compose themselves and pull a pick out of their asses, and I'll talk about Thor 131. 131 is probably the weaker of the three issues of that three-part story, but I think the cover is probably the best.
Very strong.
You get this image of Thor standing out in the cosmos with Earth in the backdrop, almost like he is the sole defender of the Earth as these alien mechanical arms reach out towards him. And you kind of got, you know, a little bit of the Kirby Dot thing going on surrounding the Earth as well. It's just a beautiful cover and a striking image. So, yeah, I'm going to go Thor 131, although it's hard to go wrong with some of those Amazing Spider-Man covers from our first episode as well. Russell, what about you? You got a cover of the year on short notice?
You know, I really don't. But, yeah, this is where I wish we would have had a little more time to to do this.
It was a spur of the moment thing.
It really is. so all those that have been mentioned were great, but there is one that's sticking out to me. I think this was... Yeah, because this one is in my recently read section. It's really jumping out at me. Fantastic Four number 53. Mm-hmm. I just really like the imagery here of the Fantastic Four along with Black Panther taking on this unknown enemy. Mm-hmm. So that, I guess, it's just that bright, very Phoenix-esque, sets my mind to that anyway, even though that's a concept that won't be introduced for some time later on down the road. I just really like the design of this cover. I think that it's illustrating some of my favorite aspects of Kirby. Mm-hmm. His ability to draw, like I've pointed out before, characters all standing together, even though this isn't the biggest group of characters I've ever seen him draw, I just really like the details of and the juxtaposition of all this red and then the green as these characters are standing in Wakanda ready to take on this unseen force. So really cool stuff, and I like how he's got such distinct character designs for each of these individuals. The way Black Panther is positioned here, the way that Johnny Storm is flying into action, Thing standing there ready to just like, you know, beat the ever living shit out of whatever's coming at him, and of course Reed turned back towards Sue, telling her not to get involved in the action as Reed was wont to do. Good stuff, good cover. Since I'm being put on the spot here, that's going to be my pick, and I will be better prepared in 1967.
I'm proud of myself for that one, Tim. What about your short notice Dick. Cover of the year?
You almost sort of have to go with. You don't have to, but to me, ASM 33 is so very iconic, and the only thing really missing from that cover would be like the floating heads of guilt that we talked about.
Couldn't tell if applause or fapping.
Both. Well, why can't it be both?
On this show,
it's both.
So, I mean, a little bit of that is informed by just knowing what awaits you in the issue itself. If you're going into something cold, I think maybe to me the most captivating, if that's a different category of cover, might be like a Tales of Suspense 80, where you've got the great action of Red Skull holding the cube. What is this? Captain America is obviously imperiled, and like me growing up as a kid, Red Skull is one of the few supervillains I kind of thought visually was a bit scary, actually. And Kirby really nails that, just that creep factor of early Red Skull. So I guess honorable mention goes to that one.
That's a good cover, too. I like that one.
And nice. Also kind of iconic, and not on the level of ASM 33, but a pretty famous Captain America cover.
Only reason I didn't pick that one was because I didn't want to have the same cover being picked every time. So,
yeah. Well, I went with Thor 131, so you know, I was a man apart, I suppose. But moving on,
clear winner.
To this point, we've given our writer of the year every year to Stan Lee, and if you guys want to make an argument for Dennis O'Neill, I will certainly give you the opportunity, but I don't feel it's necessary yet.
Not yet.
Nope.
And it's interesting because I thought Roy Thomas was kind of the next writer who picked up. We'll hear more about this on Marvel Age Masterclass, but Denny O'Neill is maybe the next writer besides, say, Larry Lieber, who gets notable bylines here besides Stan. So that happened earlier than I expected.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we're going to go with Stan Lee. And moving over to Artist of the Year. Man, this one was tough again because on the one hand, you look at the first part, you know, our first episode, and you've got that that three-part Spider-Man story, If This Be My Destiny, where Ditko is at his best, and you've got Dormammu versus Eternity in the pages of Doctor Strange. But when you look at the year as a whole and you see Jack Kirby doing things like The Coming of Galactus and like the Cosmic Cube bits with Red Skull and Captain America, and then putting a bow on it with that outstanding work in Thor with Ego the Living Planet, I got to give it to Jack Kirby here in 1966. Todd, who do you have for your Artist of the Year?
This is, to me, Kirby's strongest year so far because of the work. He was able to focus a little bit more on the individual titles he was doing, both Thor and Fantastic Four had just fantastic work, bringing it in the Captain America serial in Tales of Suspense. So, yeah, big year for Kirby. Great year for Ditko. We got to see some great work from Gene Colan, from Don Heck, but this is Kirby all the way, baby. The king reigns supreme in 66.
Tim, your Artist of the Year.
A good year artistically for pretty much everybody we saw. You got Ditko in here, of course, doing the great work that we've come to expect from him. We see our first John Romita, just again, getting a glimpse of what will await in years ahead. You know, Gene Colan, of course, making his debut on our reading list. But, yeah, hands down, Kirby. On the strength of that Coming of Galactus story alone, he would get it. But as we just talked about, that Thor trilogy, which you can't sleep on. And although he was really focusing his energies on those two titles for the most part, we forget that he is still active in the anthology split books doing Captain America. He did breakdowns on the Nick Fury Strange Tales stuff, you know, kind of pitch hitting as needed. So, I mean, tremendous year. Career highlight for sure, as Todd said. I cannot make an argument. I can't even really bring myself to try to play devil's advocate or make an argument for anyone else but Kirby.
All right, Russell, can you make an argument for anybody but Kirby?
No. this is Kirby's year. No disrespect to anybody. There was no bad art really this year. I mean, there was some that was certainly not that great looking over that Hulk story in particular, but let's just call it what it is. This was Kirby's finest hour yet. On the strength of that Thor story alone, he should get it. But everything else he did was right on. Loved the Captain America stuff. Thought that was rendered incredibly well. This man can do no wrong. This was his year. And the Fantastic Four stuff, my God, the Galactus saga, all of that, the introduction of Black Panther and all of the introduction of Wakanda and the designs there. Kirby was just at like peak power level in this year. And as Steve Ditko is unfortunately seeming to exit Marvel at this point, he does turn in like some of his absolute best work as well. But I think this is the moment where we have to say that in the struggle between Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko for like Marvel superiority, Kirby wins. He's just untouchable when it comes to this. So right on. It's a clean sweep. Jack Kirby is the artist of the year.
Absolutely. Moving on, let's get the villain of the year. And I look at this, and we had a wide assortment of characters who were tormenting our heroes, as it were. And to me, the clear standout here, the most lasting contribution to the Marvel Universe, I got to go Galactus for that three-part, you know, Coming of Galactus story in Fantastic Four. Todd, what about you?
A lot of great concepts, a lot of great villains throughout. Red Skull's return or kind of elevation to prominence. We got Ego the Living Planet in Thor. Got to see a new kind of Masters of Evil. Dr. Doom showed up in Avengers. Dr. Octopus had a great moment. Green Goblin's best fight yet, but Galactus' arrival on the scene is the crucial moment of 1966, makes him the best villain, the most enduring villain introduced that year, not just introduced, but dominating that year. So I picked Galactus.
Awesome. Russell, what about you for your villain of the year?
You know, I was really close on making an argument for Red Skull, but
I thought about that was the only other character I considered.
Like I was really close on this one, but you got to give it to Galactus. He is just, that is a force of nature. Like Red Skull is a great villain, and we're going to see him more as this goes along. It's going to be all good, but yeah, Galactus is where it's at. This is a universe threatening kind of villainy, and he's, as I said on Masterclass, he's not so much a villain as he is just a force of nature. He exists, and he's going to do what he's going to do. And this concept, the very concept of that, introduced into superhero comics, is just a tremendous idea, and I don't think there's any more that I can really add to it that Todd didn't already say. This is the year of Galactus. He is the best villain by far.
Agreed. Tim, any argument from you on a character other than Galactus?
if I was going to make the argument, it would be along similar lines as Russell alluded to. If you want to get really technical and splitting hairs about it, you can say Galactus, not really a villain, not really a hero. Galactus just is. So how can you call him villain of the year? You could look at somebody like Red Skull, who is very much a pure villain, and there's something to be gained from having Captain America's greatest adversary joining him in the present day. We also got that little retcon attached to the retcon of Bucky's death during World War II that sent Cap into suspended animation. Apparently Red Skull was behind that, so now we get more of some personal stakes to this rivalry between the two characters. That said, Red Skull a little bit too one-dimensional coming out of the gate here, so I must go with Galactus for the year as a whole.
Awesome. Moving on to our hero of the year, for me, as it has been for what feels like a while now, I'm going to go with the Amazing Spider-Man. I feel like he's the character who is growing the most over these years that we've encountered in the Marvel Universe. He's the character who feels like he is being developed, and he is the character who is being put through the emotional ringer in ways that other heroes are not. So to me, Peter Parker is still the clear and away standout when it comes to our hero. So Spider-Man's my hero of the year. What about you, Todd?
Also Spider-Man, both the If This Be My Destiny and the Green Goblin storyline in 50 and, or not 50 and 51, 39 and 40, mm-hmm. You get some great aspects of Spider-Man, him overcoming and him kind of losing, and seeing all aspects of that character. He's evolved the most. He's still the most relatable character, the most singly Marvel character there is. Spider-Man's the hero of 66 as well.
Absolutely. Russell, what about you?
I don't think you can say it any better than that. Peter Parker, the Amazing Spider-Man, easy win for him this year, though there is a somewhat argument to be made for Captain America. If I'll just make this really quick, that he was the breakout of his secondary stories, and the way that he has really stepped up to be, I think, a great leader of the Avengers. That's something that I've really enjoyed about that book, and I especially enjoyed his solo stuff. So I was toying with that idea for a minute, but no, it really is Peter Parker, the Amazing Spider-Man. This was a huge year for him. So much stuff happened that he's dealing with, and as you guys have already said, he is the most Marvel character of all Marvel characters. So it's hard not to just give this one to him in a pretty easy walk, I think.
Tim, are we going to disagree on any of these awards this year?
It doesn't seem so, because I'm going Spider-Man. He is always at his best when he is backed into a corner, put through the ringer, handed torment to go along with triumph, little victories along the way to punctuate his existence that is so wonderfully characterized by the saying, Parker luck. We see that on full display in 66. Iconic Spider-Man storytelling, and I can't wait to read more from this particular era of the character. So, yep, going Spider-Man.
All right, and we're going to wrap it up with our story of the year, and I, of course, am going to go back to The Amazing Spider-Man, and I'm going to look back to our first episode and the very first thing we covered on that first episode, which was The Amazing Spider-Man 31 through 33, the If This Be My Destiny storyline. So many things we said about it in that episode, and I will say it succinctly as this: it is arguably the most iconic story for Marvel's most iconic character. For me, it's a hands-down winner in 1966, even though I love, love, love that Thor and Ego story in the pages of Thor as well. So for me, Amazing Spider-Man, If This Be My Destiny, takes it in a walk. Todd, what about you?
No, it's not as close as you would have it. I would say that story still edges out the other two contenders. I would say that The Coming of Galactus is certainly iconic and important, but individually, I still think this monster may rate just beneath it for me. So I would say those are very close, 2 and 3, but that defining Spider-Man 31 to 33 Lee Ditko's apex of their run. The best Spider-Man moment you've ever seen in a comic. And I've been reading it since I was a little kid, so it's always been there for me. How can I not do it now? But yeah, between that, the Fantastic Four stories, the standalone, if this man, this monster, I say it wrong every time. Also enjoyed the
Crimesmaster.
Yeah, Crimesmaster. I enjoyed the Thor ego story, but that one to me wasn't as epic, although it was quite the revelation to me this time. It doesn't feel like a complete story just yet. It's kind of like a serialized thing that we can't put a bow on. It's not complete yet.
Awesome. Russell, what do you got for your story of 1966?
You know, I realize I just said that Thor story was my favorite thing, but it is fair to criticize me for recency bias on that, because we got to think back to Amazing Spider-Man 31 through 33. It's hard to deny everything that you guys just said about that story. It's fucking fantastic. And everything, it has everything I love about my favorite character in comics. So if this be my destiny, I think we're looking at another clean sweep here, though. I got to say, Thor, introduction of Ego, the Living Planet, was really, really close. It was on its heels here because that was just such a good story. So that's where I'm at. I'm going to go ahead and call it for If This Be My Destiny for every reason that both you and Todd have already covered.
All right, Tim, with our new category of cover of the year notwithstanding, are we going to have our first ever sweep of every major category where we're all in a unanimous agreement?
Well, I'm going to disappoint you, but I may not disappoint someone else, because perhaps this will redeem my cynicism and derision towards this man, this monster, because the preceding story, coming up Galactus in issues 48 through 50 of Fantastic Four, will get my story of the year honors for 66. So much of what we see in the Marvel Universe at this stage is Stan and Jack telling you these are heroes, these are characters that exist in the real world. So in order to accomplish anything in the way of like true world building, they kind of have to zoom out on it, you know? And when they do that, you bring in new concepts like the Skrulls and the blue area of the moon, the Microverse, the Inhumans right before that. Now we get Galactus. So while the Fantastic Four are probably never going to be counted among my favorite characters themselves, there is just no taking away from the contributions they've given this Marvel shared universe in the early goings here. And it's going to be exploited for years and years to come.
Outstanding. Well said, sir. I was wondering if anybody was going to give some love to the coming of Galactus, and I'm glad to hear that somebody did. So, with all that being said, that brings an end to our discussion of 1966 in the Marvel Universe. When next we meet you, dear listeners, we will be discussing part one of our talk on 1967. And for the purposes of that discussion, we're going to be looking at a whole lot of Fantastic Four and some Strange Tales. So just real quick, I'll give you the issues we're going to be covering. We will be covering Fantastic Four 57 through 60, 62 through 63, 65, and Annual 5. And then over in the pages of Strange Tales, we'll be looking at 153 to 155 and 157 to 158. So lots of FF. Lots of Doc Strange, lots of Nick Fury coming at you next time out on Marvel Age. But before we close, I'm going to give my compatriots an opportunity to plug their stuff, tell people where they can find you on the social media. Todd actually had a little bit of a family emergency, had to run. So if you want to talk to the manager on Twitter, you can hit him up at Todd Weber Guitar. He is, of course, also heavily involved with the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, which you should all go out and join, and also give the at PTBN Comics Twitter account a follow as well. So, and then I think there are rumor and innuendo that suggests that perhaps Conversation Comics will be making a comeback in the near future, but I will leave that up to Mr. Tim Capel to comment further if he chooses to do so. Tim, where can people find you? And it is that rumor and innuendo well-founded?
Well, talks are underway. That's about all I can divulge at this stage. But the manager, Todd Weber, and I have gone back to the booking committee, and we're trying to put something together, trying to work out schedules, find a time. We're committed to it. We want it to happen. We just need to see what it will take to make it happen. Beyond that, two other podcasts that I do, also on Place to Be Nation, Pop is Talking Pop, me and Jennifer Smith, getting into all the great, as you would are so fond of putting it, Nick Duke, fuck shit junk. Around the Horn, Place to Be Nation, and otherwise. So check that show out on the Place to Be Nation Pup feed, on the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. Survey Says with myself and Andy Helene. Survey Says is a WCW retrospective. We're going to be dropping our next episode looking at the pay-per-view from 1999, August of 1999. So now, gosh, the 19th anniversary, if you will, of Road Wild 1999. Wow. Should be somewhat unique.
Nothing sounds more unique. And of course, you can find him at Psych68 on Twitter if you choose to do so. Russell, what about you? Where can people find you? What do you have coming down the pipeline?
Well, folks can find me on the Twitter machine at Russell_Sellers. There you'll find me yammering on about all sorts of nonsense, everything from comics to trash cinema shark movies. Wow, that happened today. And you can also find me on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook group. Go on, join that, as Nick has pointed out. Follow the at PTBN Comics Twitter handle. And coming up in the very near future, we're getting real close now to DC Post-Crisis Management, where I will be joined by the future Village Bicycle of PTBN Pop and Comics, one Mr. Todd Weber, on the very first episode where we're going to be discussing in depth Crisis on Infinite Earths, everything from its the beginnings of its publication, what it meant to the DC universe, and the effects of it still being felt today on characters and on stories. So we're going to be getting deep on that. And of course, you're going to be finding me here on the Marvel Age podcast. And after you've listened to this, be on the lookout, because I'm going to be joining Ben Morse to discuss Marvel Age Masterclass 1966 Part 2. Just as I did recently on Masterclass Part 1, which you guys can go and listen to right now.
At Todd Weber Guitar. follow at PTBN Comics. That's where you can find me.
I already threw that love out there for you, Todd.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I handled your promotion for you because you have done the same for me so many times. It was
Yeah.
I don't know when you jumped back in there, Todd, but you may, when you go back and listen to this, hear me refer to you as the future Village Bicycle.
Oh, yeah. I've got a lot of shows coming up. And we tried to schedule a Conversation Comics the other night, but it got broadsided. So that may be coming soon as well. So, but yeah, I am nothing if not a podcast slut.
It's been good because I know there for a long time you had stepped back from an active role in podcasting to focus on your roles as a producer and a manager. And I have to say, having you back as an on-air talent has been a true delight. I can be found at NickDuke87 on Twitter. And if you want to hear me, in addition to Marvel Age, you can also listen to a show on the Place to Be Nation Pop feed. That's, you know, it's been around a little while. It covers some comic books, and it comes out every week. That's the Hard Traveling Fanboys, myself and my compatriot Greg Phillips. We just dropped an episode about a topic that I can't remember right now because they all start to run together after a while. So it's out there. I'm sure it's fine or not. I don't really know. But listen next week for another episode that I don't really know what we're covering the following week either. But we do shows. They're fine. You might enjoy them. Who's to say, really? So with all that being said, we hope you have enjoyed this discussion of Marvel, all things Marvel in 1966. We look forward to having you back for our discussion on 1967. Enough said.